Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey people, this is Ben, this is A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers, my podcast. It's nice to have you along, as always. Thank you for being a listener. And if you're a member, thank you particularly for being a member. If you do want to support the podcast, you can go over to pod.fan and join up as a member for £5 a month, which helps to keep me going in a way, even though the amount of money that I get is pretty minimal. It is at least something, and I very much value the people who kind of put their money where their mouth is, the fans of the podcast who think it's worth two cups of coffee a month. And also, bear in mind, you also get exclusive special additional content for that £5. It's not just a donation. You are paying for something extra, which is the fortnightly members only edition. So you can go over to pod.fan and sign up as a member. Anyway, didn't mean to really put that plug in straight away. It just kind of came out that way because I'm just improvising. I don't write scripts anymore for this intro, and some of you may well be asking why that is, because frankly it's sometimes a bit ragged. So I'm just gonna, you know, continue on this line of making it up as I go along. So this is the annual Photo London special. I say annual because I've been doing it kind of pretty consistently since I started 5-6 years ago. Or 6 years ago, by the way, it's the podcast birthday. That's something I should mention. It is the 6th birthday of this podcast this week. And so for those of you who've been listening from the beginning, thank you so much. And for your support. And for all of you who've sent me messages over the years, for all of you who have told me how important it is to you to listen to these conversations. And again, this is just off the cuff. I wasn't intending to say any of this, but it just occurred to me that it's the birthday of the podcast. And so when you send me a message on Instagram or by email or by any one of a bazillion different ways you can send someone a message now, and you tell me that the podcast is really important to you or that it has changed your life in some way, and people have said that to me, that's an incredible thing to hear, really. And I still, you know, never tire of hearing that sort of stuff. And it does spur me on to carry on, because sometimes I get tired, you know. I'm a bit tired now, frankly. Burnt out, I suppose, is the really correct term to use. I'm feeling a bit burnt out, and I struggle sometimes to motivate myself to continue because, as you know, there's no real money in this. And I didn't start it for that reason. And anyone who does a podcast with a view to earning money is certifiably insane, as I've said before, because they're very, very difficult things to monetize, as are many other endeavors in this day and age. But I do have members, as I said, and I love every one of you. And that brings me in a little bit of money. And of course, I have sponsorship, and the good old Charcoal Book Club, who I'll give a plug to in a minute, continue to sponsor me. And there are other people in the pipeline. So there will be sponsors coming, and I'm really looking forward to welcoming them. But I need to get some chats in the can. So anyway, where was I? Yeah, thank you for sending me those messages that you sometimes send me. That really means a lot. So yeah, Photo London, because of the aforementioned burnt outness, partly, I wasn't going to do it, actually. I didn't think I had the energy, really. And, you know, you've got to be fairly upbeat if you're going to go around sticking a microphone in random people's faces. Well, not random people, very specific people's faces. And I wasn't feeling that way at all. I was feeling like hiding, really, which I sometimes do. I'm a massive introvert, and I'm also quite shy. So you can imagine it's not easy for a person like that to be upbeat, but and to go and talk to people. But after a couple of days of faffing about, and of a couple of days of being down there, I thought, well, just come down with the microphone and just do it all again, you know. And I just, having met a few friends of the podcast, I decided, well, why not just talk to them, you know. And I don't want it to be a sort of, you know, Ben's Buddies Club thing. there are podcasts like that that I listen to, and I sometimes get slightly irritated with them. And I hope you won't feel that way listening to this, because there's a lot of people whose voices you'll be familiar with, and I kind of like that continuity in a way. And there's no analysis, there's no politics, there's no real description of the work that was on show. I didn't want to do that, really. The master of photography was Shirin Neshat, the Iranian photographer. There was a big exhibition by her. There was a big exhibition of sort of vintage Robert Capa prints from the David Kogan collection. The only public show that I mentioned was Michael Greco's Days of Punk, which you'll hear him talk about. And that was kind of random. I just happened to bump into him. And, you know, there were themes emerging and all kinds of the usual combination of stuff, really. There's no talk of, you know, commercialism or the good or bad of any of it. Incidentally, if you do want to know more about all the stuff that was there, there's a very good piece in the art newspaper by Tom Seymour. So if you go to theartnewspaper.com, I think you can get three free stories. I say that slowly because it's a bit of a tongue twister. You can read that piece online if you go to theartnewspaper.com. It's a very good overview of what was on offer this year. But I didn't get into any of that. I just spoke to people and caught up with people and recorded that process. So I hope you at least are entertained by that, because that was the main reason for doing it. So this episode of The Small Voice is sponsored, as always, by the Brilliant Charcoal Book Club, a monthly subscription service for photo book enthusiasts that brings essential, limited edition and hard-to-find photo books to your doorstep. Working with the most respected names in contemporary photography, Charcoal Book Club selects and delivers essential photo books to a worldwide community of collectors. Whether they be long-time enthusiasts with a stock library or novices just beginning to build their collection, join up as a member and each month you'll receive a new museum-quality first edition monograph to add to your shelves, hand-picked by Charcoal's team of expert curators and signed by the artist, along with a signed note card and an exclusive print. Sometimes a book of the month will be a classic title every bibliophile should own. Sometimes it will be a new release from an emerging artist who is poised to make big waves. They offer free shipping to the UK, Canada and the US, and members also get exclusive perks such as signed copies, access to rare titles, members-only pricing in Charcoal's online bookstore and more, all of which makes the Charcoal Book Club the best and most exciting way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. Still enjoying the book of the month coming through to me every month, and I've mentioned a few recent ones, and there'll be more mentions coming up in the next few weeks, I think. Maybe even there'll be someone coming on who, well, shit, why would I say that? God, I've only just sent the email. But we'll see what happens in terms of Book of the Month Club photographers chatting with me. In October, the Chico Hot Springs Portfolio Review is happening in Montana. It happened earlier in the year online when it was completely impossible to do it physically, but the one in October is going ahead physically, and that is the postponed one from last year, the 2021, if that isn't too confusing. And you know, I'm invited, of course, and I'd love to go, and I hope I can go, but right now I'm not allowed to enter the United States, obviously, for COVID protocol reasons, and I don't know whether there's going to be any way around that, but it's very likely that I won't be going, but I hope I am. And I will keep my fingers crossed, but I won't get my hopes up, let's put it that way. Prepare for the worst and hope for the best. So anyway, here's the Photo London Special 2021. Okay, I'm doing it. I wasn't going to do it, but I rethought that decision, and I'm going to do it. So here's the intro. I'm at Somerset House, and if you're hearing this, then it worked. It went okay, I presume. At the moment, I have absolutely nothing, but I have been here already. I came on Wednesday on the preview day, and obviously I have my microphone, but I didn't talk to anyone on the mic. I actually spent most of the time looking at the work. That was the preview day, the Wednesday. So I was looking at the work, you know, which is basically what the point of it is, I suppose. And, you know, as usual, there was a lot of it. And, you know, I've said all this before. It's a lot to deal with in one chunk. But I did have a good look round, and I tried to just relax about it instead of getting really stressed out about how overwhelming it is. So that was all right. And then I came again yesterday, and that was kind of a social day where I spoke to and bumped into quite a lot of old friends, friends of the podcast, friends of mine, and people who fall into both categories. And that was really nice. And again, wasn't really feeling it. And to be honest, I'll tell you now, good listener, I was thinking, I don't think I'm going to do the podcast this year, because partly I don't want to just repeat myself, and I felt like I probably was going to. And then also I was a bit kind of reluctant to dive in. And, you know, you have to know that I'm fundamentally a very shy person. So sticking a microphone in people's faces does not come naturally to me at all. Not even one little bit, I'll tell you so much, that much. And also walking around talking into this thing on my own also is a slightly bizarre experience. But you know that already. I've said that before. Anyway, I wasn't feeling it. And then I woke up this morning and I was like, Ben, the listeners deserve something from Photo London, for goodness sake, especially the members. So I am resolved to bring you something from Photo London. And I think the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to check out the book publishing people and see who's around. Oh, look. Hey, I'm in the Tashin gallery. And there's an absolutely mahusif, very limited edition book by Sebastio Salgado, which they're just showing to people. Comes with its own special stand designed by Renzo Piano. It needs a stand as well, because it, tell you what, it weighs about 1,000 tons. But it's a humongously big thing, and the price is 3,000 quid. So not cheap, but arguably worth it if you've got that kind of dosh. There's also some prints, limited edition Salgado prints at 7,500 quid. This is all the Amazonia project, which is his newest book, which you can just go and buy for a normal amount of money. And that is in itself quite a big old thing. Most of Salgado's books are. But it's, you know, that would be more affordable, let's face it, for most of us. But the limited edition one's pretty spectacular. Anyway, I'm going to see who else is around. Let's check out our friends at Satanta Books. Hi, Tom.
You're right. How you doing?
Good. You?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
Have you got time for a chat? Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. No
How's
worries.
It going?
Yeah, it's going good. It's nice to see people.
Have you sold anything?
Yeah, we just sold quite a few expensive books, some Peter Hugo books. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, what have you brought in the way of exotic and rare stuff?
Exotic and rare. Well, we just sold a Nollywood by Peter Hugo. We've got Vanessa Winship's She Dances on Jackson.
How much that's worth? Because I've got a signed copy of that, as you might imagine.
Is it a first edition or a second edition?
First edition.
I'd say 250.
That's pretty good. That's not bad. That might be one of my better acquisitions. Obviously, I didn't pay for it. Because she's a buddy, and that's one of the privileges of being in that position. But yeah, no, sorry, I interrupted you, Tom. What Peter Hugo? That was one you sold.
Yeah, we sold two Peter Hugos, La Cucaracha. No, I probably butchered the pronunciation of that. Nollywood, and a Nadav Kander, The Meeting.
Yeah, I saw him lingering about yesterday. You were talking to him about the fact that he'd signed some books. And he seemed slightly perplexed, but then he got it. He got it in the end. Now, also, Satanta are now publishing their own books,
yes.
And I have a couple of them. What can you tell me about that's kind of interesting or new that, you know, is something you might want to talk about?
We've just published a book by a woman called Manaris. That's kind of her stage name. Her real name is Paola Franchi. It's called Mementos, and it's a really great book. We're really pleased with it. It was quite the production headache to make. It's got black borders and a UV spot varnish, and it took a while to get right.
That's fantastically geeky kind of photo book nerdery there that I think the listeners would appreciate. But yeah, so that one's come out. What have you got in the pipeline that might be a kind of exciting thing?
We've got a book by a woman called Tiny Cactus on Instagram. Her name's Kang He, and that book is coming in the next couple of months. We're currently in the production stages, so yeah, keep an eye out for that.
I will. Interesting. Thank you, Tom. Well, that was brilliant, and it's great to see, you know, Satanta making their own books now instead of just flogging other people's. I like the flogging other people's, but I can't afford them anyway, so good luck. I'll see you soon.
Yeah,
thanks, Tom. Okay, that's Tom from Satanta Books. Satanta being now a publisher as well as a bookseller. Amak. Amak Mumudian's here, looking fantastic. I'm recording, yeah. I just had a hug. Good to see you. You look fabulous. What have you been up to?
Just looking around, looking for friends again in real life, not through the screen. Then it's exciting, and everything is fantastic.
I love that positivity. What's going on work-wise?
It's okay. It could be better, but it's fine. I'm surviving. I'm working on project rather than thinking about promotion these days, man.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, play it close to your chest for now, and you can tell us more about it another time. Yeah, see you later.
See you around.
Bye. That's Amak Mahmoudian, previously of this parish. Nice to see her. She's probably feeling a bit self-conscious about the fact I just shoved the microphone in her face unannounced. As people want to do. But that's the way it goes. Unfortunately. For Amak in this case. But yeah. Probably didn't really expect that. So Loose Joints are also there. Nice book publisher. But didn't have the right person to talk to. They, I had a look at them yesterday. And they had some nice stuff. And they had books that I can no longer name. That's why I went to speak to them. But unfortunately, it wasn't possible. Quite a lot of book publishers not here this year. MacBooks are not there. Darry Lewis is not there. Hoxton Mini Press are there, but they get enough free publicity on this podcast as it is, much as I love them. And, Ghost Books are there again, who, you know, whose photographers get quite a lot of play. Because they're good, and, you know, they're a good publisher. I like their stuff. We'll play it by ear. We'll improvise. I've bumped into Kalpesh the Thicker, another friend of the podcast. Hi, Cal. Haven't seen you for a while.
Hey, Bern. It's been age.
So nice to see you, man. That's the lovely thing about coming here, especially after we've had a year and a half of not seeing anyone.
It's great. You've seen my beard now grow vastly unrecognisable. Yeah, it's really good, actually. It feels quieter. You can hear it, actually. So you can walk around a bit more.
It is a bit quieter. The beard looks great. I had wind of the fact that you were working on a book project of some sort. Can you tell me about it?
I can. I'm still doing Memoir Temporal. It is in... Well, the design is done. We're waiting on the printer to get some dummies back because there's been a backlog of material.
Of course.
Of course. So as soon as we have that, we can then make a start. I mean, the book's in place. We just got to get a dummy to look at. But Ben McLaughlin at BAM is doing the design, which I'm really happy about. And Emmanuel, she's around here somewhere, who's my co-collaborator on the book. She's
What's Emmanuel's surname?
Perry. Emmanuel Perry.
And so you did it together?
Yeah. So it's like, I was done the photography. Emmanuel's been the kind of, I guess, the powerhouse behind the idea and actually, I guess, fleshing out really what the work's about, which is about kind of these ideas about memories from my past.
Well, I was going to say, maybe you could just kind of flesh it out a bit and explain to the listeners what is the essence of the book and its content.
So, as most of your listeners might know or might not know, I'm of South Asian origin, Indian. My grandparents left India and moved to Africa, East Africa, in Kenya and Zanzibar. I was born in the UK. We grew up with all these memories of this place, this kind of motherland. And these memories, I couldn't quite work out whether they were perceived or real or embedded or whatever. But then after the whole Brexit fiasco and being on the road during the kind of referendum, it made me question my place in this country. Mm. And I started thinking about, well, where do I belong? So this idea came that I would go back to a city that could have been my home. And that would have been Mumbai. And subsequently, I found out my grandfather actually, when he was a teenager, went from Gujarat to Bombay and worked there for a few years. So we could have ended up there. And so really, it's not a tour, like a travel west sort of thing. It's more about kind of pictures that resonate with the idea of memory. So it could be flowers. It could be a couple of, like a girl I could have married, a boy who could have been me. So, you know, and the other thing is this, very different from Lost in the Wilderness in the sense that I actually cast the characters in this book.
Yeah, so it's sort of that lovely kind of area between fact and fiction, in a sense, or kind of between documentary, but also something that's a bit more pre-arranged in a way. Or
yeah, I mean, I definitely in terms of the, you know, we had this conversation before about, you know, documentary and kind of what is art and what isn't art. But the thing is, I just felt that this allowed me a lot of freedom to make work without anything other than my experiences. And so that allowed me to say, okay, this young man could have been me, and then they dressed them up as me.
Right.
And some of it was just, and other times you just find people, but then also there's things like landscapes. The sea plays a big role in the idea of crossing this ocean, and there's this thing called Kali Nagi, which is like the black water. I'm sure my Indian friends are going to pull me up on that.
I'll just edit it so it sounds like you're...
Sorry, Kalapani, that's what it's called. Okay. Kalapani, black water. When you cross the black water, you lose your Indianness.
Interesting.
But the interesting thing is that most of us immigrants, or immigrant stock, we hold on to it even tighter. We're more rooted in it. And the country that we romanticise, that nostalgia of a place that we're meant to come from, has moved on. Doesn't even exist anymore. But I had a lot of help, you know. I love like Prathna Singh over there, who kind of like really helped me find my... And Emmanuel, I can't... I mean, she's disappeared, but she sent me a wonderful text from a Turkish writer called Orhan Pamuk. And spoke about something called uzun, this kind of melancholic want, need, romance, whatever you want to call it.
Fascinating. I can't wait to see. I'm really looking forward to it. And well, I'll tell you what, though, when it does come out properly, come on the...
I'll do a proper show.
Come do a proper check-in on the Members Podcast, because that's what those are for. And it'd be lovely to hear more about it.
I would love to, Ben. I missed you, man.
You too, mate. Thanks so much. It's really nice to catch up.
Give you a hug.
Yeah. That's fine.
All right.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I just bumped into Jenny Lewis previously of this parish. Very often on this parish, actually. Jenny did a check-in, as the members will know, quite recently, and was on doing a full chat, I don't know, quite a while ago now. Nice to see you. How are you doing?
I'm feeling really, really happy. A little bit tired from bumping into lots of friends here yesterday. But I think as much as the Camparis, it might be that sort of rush of adrenaline and feeling a bit giddy for seeing lots of people and just all talking over each other and giggling and being really silly. And it's not what I remember Photo London being about. It used to be quite serious. But now we haven't been anywhere or done anything. It feels like a complete thrill to be here, almost more for the people that I'm bumping into than the pictures. Pictures as well.
That's an interesting observation.
Like, it's so nice to see everyone.
I think that's a very interesting point that you make. Yes, it's really good to see people. And if any of us are going to get COVID, we're probably going to get it now.
I know, we said that. Like 18 of us went for dinner last night. We're like, oh my God, we're going to all go down in one bang now.
We shouldn't even be joking about it. It's just tempting fate. But it's nice to hug people. And the mask protocol thing is a bit confusing because no one... You know, really knows. I don't know. I mean, some people have a strong view one way or the other, but I'm just inconsistent. Like I've, you know, it's like
a lot of the meeting people though is outside, which is nice here. You've got this massive courtyard,
yeah.
So you can go off on your own and look at the work and have your mask on and be respectful to everyone in the rooms and the gallery owners. But when you're outside, bumping into your mates, you can actually see them, and it is getting a bit huggy.
It's nice to be outside though, and the weather's been good for once. Yeah. We talked about the fact that you have no less than 3 pictures in the upcoming Taylor Wessing Portrait Award. And I'm sure I've had you on the microphone before bemoaning the fact that you never...
I know, often moaning.
You never got in. And then suddenly you get 3 in at once. That is...
It's really greedy, isn't it?
How's
that
feel?
It's really greedy. It feels brilliant to get the pictures in the Taylor Wessing. It feels brilliant. There's actually going to be an exhibition that people can see. You know, you don't often get the opportunity to print things, or I don't anymore. So to actually print them on beautiful paper and you know, see them like that is a massive thrill. And they'll get an audience, you know, an audience that maybe wouldn't have seen the book.
Mm. This is all from your 100 Years project, which appeared as a book with Hoxton Mini Press. Yeah. And we talked about it on the members podcast. But who were the three people, just briefly, who were the three people who have made it into the exhibition, your subjects?
Probably the one that people will know most is Reenie, who was 100. So she's the book cover. So that's probably the most familiar image. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of wonderful to celebrate her life.
She's still with us.
She's very, very, very fragile at the moment. Mm-hmm. She's moved into a home. She's no longer living on her own in her own flat. So I actually posted that yesterday, I think, that it was going to be in the exhibition. And one of her care workers at the care home sent me a message going, oh, I'll have to tell Reenie tomorrow, she's such a joy. Mm-hmm. So the care home's amazing, and they're, you know, they'll come to the exhibition. And it's just lovely to tell people that they're going to be celebrated in a like really fantastic, fancy exhibition.
Yeah, yeah. Who were the other two?
The other two were King, who's 37, and he's holding his one-day-old baby. So he was the one that linked to my original project, One Day Young.
Yeah, I remember that one.
But obviously that's the father's, you know, image rather than a mother. And then the other one is Anka, who's 41. She's in it as well.
Awesome. Well, people can find them, or they can look at, maybe they could go to the Hoxton Mini Press website and have a look at the book or something. Yeah, but also, go, if they can get into London, not everyone's in London, not everyone's even
not
in the UK.
But they'll be, you can go on my Instagram and see them.
On your Instagram? Okay, that would be the way.
That's the easiest thing.
What's your Instagram?
It's, it's a really annoying one to say, but it's @_JennyLewis_. And then you can see the dates for where the exhibition is, because the National Portrait Gallery is shut at the moment. So it's at a place called Cromwell Place in South Kensington, and the dates are on there.
Okay, cool. Well done, Jenny. You can't whinge anymore.
I know, man. What am I going to do now? I've got to just be happy.
Yeah, I mean, three in 1 year. That's your lot, mate.
I'm done now. I don't have to keep entering it and having all that stress every year.
That's great. Thank you for chatting.
Pleasure. Always a pleasure to see you working, Ben.
Yeah, working I am.
Working, never shirking.
I have bumped into Alice Tomlinson, friend of the podcast, as we know, and we've done a members check-in recently. In fact, everyone I've spoken to today has already sort of been through that process. But I did want to ask you, because it's ongoing work, and that is, how's the Nun documentary going, if I may refer to it in such a way?
Yes, you may. Well, it's going very well, but there's been kind of big development.
Tell me.
The nun is no longer a nun.
No way.
Yeah, so we got a call in at the beginning of the year, very dramatic call, to say that she'd fled the convent kind of overnight.
Oh my gosh, I so wasn't expecting this, Alice. Thank God I actually decided to ask you about this, because I was thinking, oh, I might just give Alice a pass, you know, let's just leave her alone, let her enjoy her Campari. But, okay, so tell me more. Now, in terms of the film, this has got to be a fabulous thing, right, in terms of your story.
Yeah, so when we first heard the news, obviously Cecile, the co-director, and I were kind of concerned for Vera, or Olga, she's reverted back to her birth name now, so Olga's kind of welfare, because we didn't really know what was happening. And also, because she'd been someone I was so kind of certain and so sure of her deep faith that I thought lots of things might happen with the film, of, you know, dealing with real life, who knows what's going to go on, but I didn't expect that to be the storyline exactly.
Yeah.
So obviously, in terms of the kind of narrative structure of the film, it's very exciting for us. And then to make it even more bizarre, we went for 6 weeks in Belarus to try and finish the film. We then found out that she was actually planning on going to France, and so we were in June. We were filming her for, actually ended up being 3 or 4 weeks. She's now looking after horses just outside of Arles, bizarrely. So it's this very strange kind of, and obviously I know Arles pretty well from the festival. And she just feels a lot, it came as a big shock, but she feels a lot freer, and it's complicated. There's not like one big reason why she left. It wasn't a sudden epiphany. It sounds dramatic, but it had obviously been building up for a long time. And I think she found just the structure and the restrictions of the Orthodox Church too much in the end, and I think she realised she didn't want to spend the rest of her life there.
Right. So she hasn't necessarily lost her faith or renounced her faith, but she, you know, there's a difference between having some faith and actually being a nun, which is an extreme. But in a weird way, I'm wondering if the process of getting to know you and, you know, being part of your project and all that might have had some kind of influence on her thinking.
Yeah, I mean, we have considered that, and I would hope it hasn't. I mean, I don't think it's been a huge factor, but I think perhaps meeting us and spending a lot of time with us and kind of seeing the lives that we lead, really. Oh, here's Jenny with the Campari. Thank you.
Quick Campari break.
Don't name check me. Sorry, Jenny.
These women are drinking hard liquor at all kinds of hours of the day. I tell you what, they can, yeah, they'll give you a run for their money. I'm a wuss. I don't drink during the day.
It came as a big surprise to us, but we're actually much closer to her now. After filming her in France, we feel we've got a much better understanding of her, and she says in lots of ways she was kind of putting on a bit of a front for her last few years. Mm-hmm. And she certainly hasn't. First of all, there were rumours in the convent that she'd renounced Christianity. She hasn't, but she still believes there is a God, or there are gods, but she doesn't believe in the kind of preaching, if you like, or the belief of the Orthodox Church anymore, or she feels more of a distance from that.
That's fascinating. And when you say she fled, that sounds dramatic, but that might just mean that she sort of, you know, packed her bag and just...
Yeah, but it was all in the night time and aided by her sister. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a kind of dramatic departure, I think. But obviously unfortunately we weren't there for that, because we didn't know it was going to happen.
Of course, yeah, that would have blown it. Well, that is genuinely fascinating. I think that, you know, in terms of the story, it's really going to give it another level, right?
Yeah, certainly an unexpected twist that I think allows us to really delve deeper into her very complex personality.
Does that mean you've sort of going to extend the shooting schedule now, because obviously you've got a whole new thing to look at?
Well, we spent a lot of time with her in France in the Camargue, where she was working for a kind of tyrannical horse mistress or master, if you like. So we got some really interesting footage there. But I think because Olga is so unpredictable in some ways, I mean, she was talking at one point about going to Kilimanjaro, and we thought we can't just continue following her because, I mean, we don't have the funds and who knows where she's going to go next. So it feels like the natural end. We think we have now finished the filming, unless there's any kind of gaping holes in the kind of narrative. So we're now looking at the edit, which is obviously a huge kind of process in itself. We did get some funding from Sundance, which was brilliant, which really helped us with the last trip. But now we're, you know, it's an ongoing saga, looking for more money finish it.
Well, I hope it makes it into production. Well, not into production. I hope it makes it to our screens. But what an amazing character she must be. And I just look forward to sort of seeing the thing when it's finally put together.
Yeah, I've got masses of admiration for her, because she's really kind of followed her instincts. It was really brave and really hard for her to leave the church after over 20 years, but she kind of knew she had to, and she's a very kind of a free spirit now, and she's loving life. And it's weird, because in lots of ways she's very naive. She doesn't really know how the world works, because she's been in this very kind of quite cloistered, like secretive community. So she's kind of relearning and readjusting to being out in the real world, but she's been very open and honest with us, and as a result I hope the film will have kind of deeper layers.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so and this of course was one of the characters who sort of featured prominently in your Ex Voto book. I never know what to say. It's Voto or Voto.
Voto,
anyway, whatever. Ex Voto. And you know, people will definitely, I mean, they'll be familiar with the picture of it, because it was one of the ones that kind of
when you see
got
the difference. It will be interesting, I think, for people, because the difference is extreme.
I can't wait to see her.
I won't say too much more.
All right, good. Thank you, Alice.
Thank you.
Right, bumped into another friend of the podcast. He's now deep in conversation. Bumped into Robin Maddock, also Simon Bainbridge, recently of the BJP, British Journal of Photography, long-time editor. Robin, you got a new book.
Yeah. Are you going to look at it, or are we just going to...
Do you want to tell me about it?
Around it?
I am going to look at it, but don't bear in mind the fact that you're on an audio podcast whereby the listeners cannot see anything. You have to actually tell us something.
Okay.
Is this a dummy?
No. I'll take that as a compliment. But no, it's 750 copies, printed at Wilco's a few weeks ago. It was lots of dummies, so some of the dummy work has made its way into a book, which is a kind of bricolage of many different formats and many different different periods of photographing. But most of it's England since the referendum.
Okay. Yeah. Now, the reason I ask, because you've gone for a sort of quite a lo-fi kind of, almost a scrapbooky kind of introduction to it, in a sense that where we've got, you know, like, I don't know, I lose the powers of any kind of descriptive.
Well, it's beyond description, isn't it, really? But no, the every single one is hand sprayed on the front, because I got the cover and I wasn't sure about the title and I didn't like the way it looked. And so I've made every single one an individual thing, and it's been quite fun. And they've all got a different title because I couldn't settle on a title. I used to send lists and lists to friends of like 20 titles, and they would always, I'd settle on one, and then they'd say, oh, that sounds a bit like the new Dua Lipa album. and then I'd be like, shit, I've got to start again. So actually I came to this idea that maybe each one should have its own title, depending on who I'm giving it to, how I feel at that moment, and going back through my long list, because England is whatever it is to anyone. So impossible project, not very fashionable to do a project about a whole country. But in response to the fact that the right wing have harnessed a lot of ideas about the nature of a country, and I feel that the left has not responded in a politically powerful way. So I guess it's very personal, but it's also very much a response to what happened to the country while I was living abroad. You know, I was in Lisbon when the referendum result came in, but I was actually sat in Toulouse when I found out the result, and pretty much hung up my flip-flops, came back and travelled around for 3 years of photographing. But there's a lot of old archive pictures that never made it into other projects, the other two books I did on England. Mm. So it was quite complicated to put together because, there's a lot, and it was also many different formats. And, it was too big, and it was even reduced by a lot at the last minute. So I had to design it myself, I felt, to make sense of all these different periods and times and formats.
Is that your first foray into designing the thing?
Yeah, it was painful. I mean, InDesign sat on your backside for a year. Lockdown really helped with that, because it was it's very strange to move things a couple of millimetres, and I don't know if I'll ever do that again. But so it's a mixture of InDesign work and also things that were done by hand in previous dummies. I feel I kind of resolved it in the end. I couldn't do more. I was sort of exhausted. I felt like I was going to end up with a Eugene Smith kind of Pittsburgh job, you know, where you just lose it completely and never comes out. So, yeah. As Pelé said after the 1970 World Cup final, I didn't die. I didn't die. I didn't die.
Well, how can people get hold of it?
There's a link in the bio of my Instagram to my website, so you can find me on Instagram, Robin Maddock, or robinmaddock.com, and they're still at £35 each. So we've had a few good early sales, and I've sent out only 10 to people I really like and respect, it's going all right. I'm kind of thinking about it having its own life and not rushing it. I don't really know how you do press and PR these days, because I haven't done a book for about 10 years and everything's changed since then. So I'm kind of letting it find its own audience. I've had some help from friends on Instagram who've got a lot more followers than me. I want people to see it and then to grow in its own way, and there's no rush, really.
No, exactly. Well, look, I don't want to say too much more, because I want to get you to come on and do a proper check-in on the Members Only podcast. Will you do that for me?
I would love to.
Good. Well, let's do that, and then we can talk more, because I think there's a lot to talk about, and I want to do it justice properly when we can talk properly. But so there's no point in telling people what it's called, because it's called lots of different things.
Yeah, so what's this one called? This one's called... Low England or I'm High.
Okay, fascinating. Yeah. Well, thank you, Robin. It looks really interesting, man. I look forward to talking more about it at a later stage.
Cheers. Well, the good things about your interviews are you've done a little bit of research before we talk.
I try to.
I find that it makes things a lot cooler, you know, because you actually know what you're talking about. So, let's do it.
Yeah, thanks, man. I'm talking to Bryony Carlin, who I met yesterday for the first time. And the reason I want to talk to Bryony is because for her sins she's done a PhD in photo books, and so I'm fascinated to know what that involves and what one learns in the process of doing a PhD in photo books. Not, you don't have to tell me all of it, because otherwise we'd be here for a week. But no, seriously though, well, what are your origins in terms of your, you know, practice and like how you got to undertake such a thing, an endeavour?
Well, before I was doing my PhD research full time, I was also working as as an assistant curator of photographs at the V&A, and did a couple of other jobs as well that involved working with books and things and configuring books and objects and photographs in spaces. And so working with physical things was always really important to me. And at the time, I applied for this research in 2016, so it was quite a while ago. And at the time, I didn't feel that a lot that I was reading about photo books was really sort of engaging with the books as objects. I thought quite a lot of talk about photo books was more about it's about this photography project, but it didn't really address the sort of materiality of the book. And as a curator, I'm very interested in how we experience things in space, like what are the environments that you come into contact with photographs and artworks and images, and how did that shape the meaning that you make from those sort of images. And I started thinking about photo books in like more theoretical directions, from sort of thinking about how we read them and understand them and touch them, and then also the places where we find them. So like in our homes, but also in libraries or museums or book fairs. Sometimes they're behind glass, so you can't actually look at them and read them in the way that you would want to. So I was really just thinking about all of these other issues that are maybe sort of things that surround the photo book rather than kind of what is a photo book. So the thesis is really, it's not a history of photo books, because I think there's enough of those being produced. It's more of a study of what do we do with them and what do they do for us. They mean different things for different people, whether you're a collector or if you're an artist. You might make photo books for all different reasons. Sometimes they're sort of these promotional tools to show people your project. Sometimes they are the artwork itself. It's like a very total thing that you can have creative control over. And so it's really just been me sort of interviewing different practitioners, curators, collectors, artists, about how they relate to photo books, what they do with them. And also doing some writing about sort of reflecting on my own relationship to photo books and sort of meaningful ones that have that I've also had different encounters with at various points in time. Books kind of, we think they stay the same, but they're also actually changing a lot. They get wear and tear. They might. I've got a first edition of In Flagranti by Chris Killip, which had that kind of laminated softback cover, and it goes really yellow, but it also has this sort of white imprint on one of the covers, one side, where it's been sat next to some other books on a bookshelf. And this was obviously before I owned it, so I don't know what the life of this book was before. But then I left it on a table where the shadow actually got evened out again. So the kind of, but embarrassing to admit being a curator. But it's all part of the, we think of them as the very static objects that stay the same. But even as when you make something in a book, it's not like a sort of finite finished object that is immovable, because it can be transported, it can be cut up, it can have all the best pictures cut out and put in frames because you can't afford the prints. So they're these very just sort of actually quite hybrid, moving, mutable thing that the more I sort of started thinking about, well, what is a book and why do you make a book, the more questions they asked, really.
That is fascinating. So now, are you now sick of photo books, having spent so long sort of immersed in them?
I don't think I could ever be completely sick of them. I think I'm keen to... I think it's quite easy when you do a PhD in something that then people think, oh yeah, you must be, you just do this now. Yeah. You just do photo books now. And yeah, so I'm kind of still wanting to do other...
Yeah, of course. No, you don't want to be a pigeon. Oh yeah, Bryony, she's the photo book gal.
Because actually I know very little about like the photo book canon. People are always saying to me, oh, so you must know this book. And
Well, you're approaching it from an academic perspective. It's not the same as, you know, like getting kind of geeky about, you know, which books are collectible and et cetera, although you're presuming found out stuff about that as well. But like what? So you must have had some fascinating conversations with, I don't know, Martin Parr or people like that who are sort of renowned for being big collectors and that sort of thing. I'm not saying him specifically, but what are some of the things that sort of stick in your mind from the kind of conversations that you had?
Well, the most interesting conversations that I had were actually with people who work with photo books, I suppose, in a less public way. So people who perhaps catalogue them in libraries. There's lots of really fascinating thought around sort of working with books and objects that you might not think about as you're sort of looking at photo books at a book fair, for example. Like when you work in a museum, you have to decide whether something goes in a particular section. Is it art? Is it photography? Do you put it as a special collection book because it's quite fragile, or do you put it in the general collection? And these are quite subtle decisions that can actually have an impact on how that book is then presented and perceived. So if you put it in the special collections of the kind of more fragile art object, then people might not be able to handle it in the same way. And so then it comes with these conditions of engagement that might frame how people then interpret what they're looking at, or might inhibit them from accessing it in the first place. So there's all of these other layers that I think as a curator and at Very Points Museum practitioner, I find these other kind of facets of how we shape our understandings of what different kinds of creative practice are, and those understandings come from the way they are framed in organisations. I don't mean like put in a picture frame, but sort of conceptually framed by the way galleries and curators and writers behave and describe things. That's also how we understand objects, as well as handling them physically for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff, Brian. Thank you so much. You did that brilliantly, and you're very articulate about it, so no doubt you were the right person to embark on this project. And you're now my official go-to photo book expert if I want that academic perspective. Thank you for chatting with me.
My pleasure.
I bumped into Matt Finn. Hello, Matt. How are you, mate?
Very good, but I wish I was with him at the Campari stand, to be honest with you, but it's always nice talking to you anyway.
Well, you were going to get one in, though, aren't you?
Definitely.
Tell me about what you've been up to. What's this film they're making about you?
So a friend of mine who I studied with at Derby, many, many moons ago, who's actually a really good filmmaker, who's been making a series of documentaries on photographers, we've been doing this, which kind of really works well with how I work on duration. So we've been collaborating, which seems to be a buzzword at the moment, for several years on this film. So although it's not like 30 years of work, we've been working for about 4 years now, on and off, filming me, doing pieces. And it's really an overview of kind of my practice. So we've been working together with me re-photographing students from the School of Art in the 90s. We're actually going to revisit my mother's house, where I made all the photographs from the series Mother. We've got a surprise special guests who've been very, very kind and have said hopefully some wonderful things, even though I've not heard them. People like Ali Sof, which is incredible. Dowie Lewis is going to be filmed. There's other people who've been kind of involved. And I guess it'll be about 30 minutes, otherwise, you know, the world will be completely bored. 30 minutes of Matthew Finn's probably far too long anyway, but it's just a really nice thing, which is hopefully just going to add a little bit of a sense of reality and understanding about, you know, not only my practice as a photographer, but I guess photographers' practice in general, and a bit about the history and background of the works. So I think for me it would be nice to just to be able to show people that, you know, it's not just about here we have a selection of photographs, but actually here are the houses, here's dialogues, here's conversations with other people, and the thoughts of other people as well. So for me, it's been great to work with a very good friend of mine from way back when we were students at Derby, from 1991. My God, that seems a long time ago, doesn't it? So I'm really looking forward to this coming out. Like everything else, it's been prolonged because of COVID, but a bit like my photography, we're in no rush.
Right, absolutely. So, and then, like, you've gone and caught up with some of the people who feature in the School of Art book. Was that something you were planning on doing anyway? Did that come out of doing this film then?
No, I mean, that was something I was always on the back of my mind, and it was one of those things, like one of those days you just casually, whereas before you just maybe secretly Google their name, which always seemed a bit, you know, dubious. Oh, very much so, yes. Whereas it just feels more less stalkerish if you do it in Instagram or Facebook.
Absolutely.
So I found several of them, contacted them, and then I set up this School of Art Ridge Street Facebook site, and before you know it, it was 200 students on. Some who was there in the 80s who I didn't know, but plenty who I did know. And then we all started sharing photographs that we'd taken all of each other, reminiscing about memories. And it just came from that. And then when I published the book School of Art, I managed to get lots of them. So at the ICA launch, we had a lot of students who come up. So from that, it's just expanded. You
That's
know.
Great. It's really interesting. It's fascinating to kind of just, I don't know, that passage of time between, you know, one and the other, and to sort of see how people's lives have panned out. There's always an interesting process. So when's this program going to see the light of day, and what's it going to be called, you know?
I don't know the title. We did have a lot of, when I say we, the director had a lot of issues with the licensing fees for some of the music that we wanted to do, but we've that's been sorted. As I say, I think we've got most of the footage of me, maybe another day shooting, and then a lot of the editing's been done. I'm hoping, you know, Parifoto is going to be too soon, probably next year, but we're looking for a launch again, kind of a wide distribution launch, if that's even something that's possible, you know, with a photography documentary.
Yeah. Oh man, well, good. I hope it comes to light soon, and I look forward to seeing it. Nice to see you, Matt.
Yeah, you too. Lovely to be here. Lovely to be at Photo London, and it's lovely to. I feel like I need to just want to go and touch photographs, but I'm not allowed.
No, don't touch them, for God's sake. No. But I know what you mean.
Yeah, cheers, man.
Now I'm in the bowels of the building at Somerset House. We just got taken down to a very cool little place. It's called the Paint Room, and there's like a coffee shop and stuff. I still kind of like, I can't believe this is down here, but anyway, I digress, because anyway, the reason I'm here is because I'm with Elizabeth Waterman, and she has kind of arranged a little kind of private party here, which is very enterprising of you, Elizabeth. Elizabeth is married. Are you married to Michael?
I am.
She's married to Michael Greco, who's also got a brilliant show here called The Days of Punk, which I saw yesterday. I'm going to talk to Michael in a minute, but I want to talk to Elizabeth first, because she's got a book out, and it's called, you can tell us.
Sure, it's called Money Game, and it's a
Money Game.
It's a look of strippers in the United States. So
Okay, so what drew you to that as a subject? How did it all start? You may have to kind of give us the backstory a little bit.
Well, I just think strippers are amazing. They're sexy, they're powerful, they're beautiful, and I admire them. And so I wanted to see what that world was about. And I hadn't seen many photographs of, you know, strippers in their lives and in the clubs. And it was kind of a hard world to crack into. And so I went on a little bit of an adventure. Mm. And for 4 years, I went to clubs all over the United States, different cities, and I got to peek into their world.
Mm. When you say you feel that they're powerful, what do you mean by that? Maybe you can expand on it a bit, because I'm not sure whether I think that's true.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a misconception that sometimes that they're not empowered, but a lot of the strippers that I met and that I encountered were really just using their sexuality as a commodity. Mm. And they were using it in a way they wanted to use it. And it was an asset that they had, and they were capitalizing on it. And it was something that really worked for them. And I thought that that was really cool to see.
Mm-hmm. So, like, I guess, yeah, it would have been maybe a little bit of a time-consuming process to get to a point where, you know, you were trusted and you were sort of welcomed into that world. What was that like? I mean, was there a certain kind of moment when things kind of fell into place somehow? That's quite often the way it works. Or was it more of a kind of slow kind of matter of patience?
Well, it was definitely, I had to be patient. It took probably 4 months to get access into my first club. And I just went to a lot of clubs and asked, you know. A lot of clubs said no. I got a lot of no's. And eventually I found some clubs in New York in the outer boroughs that let me into the club to take pictures. And then I hung out in the locker rooms of strip clubs for a long time just talking to the dancers. And I started taking pictures, you know, well, like months later. So it took a while for them to trust me and to sign model releases and to understand what I was doing. And then, you know, to see the pictures that I had taken and to like them. And so it definitely it was a process.
Yeah, yeah. And what was, I presume most of them have seen the pictures of themselves. I mean, what were the kind of reactions did you get from them?
They really liked them. You know, they liked how they looked. They liked that I didn't sexualize them. And I was looking at them more from just a place of admiration, and I was elevating them. Mm-hmm. And that was different from perhaps a traditional male gaze.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I mean, this is a classic example of the kind of project that you as a woman, you know, have got a much better chance of doing, or of doing period, really, but to be doing in a way that, you know, you can be, they're going to relate to you in some way, and they're going to trust you more, I would guess, and there's going to be a bit more kind of empathy and stuff going on. But, you know, what did you learn from them in a way, if that's not too kind of wide?
Oh, no, they taught me a lot. I feel like the strippers taught me some of the best parts. I mean, they taught me that a woman's sexuality is her own to do with whatever she wants. So it's yours. You can use it. You can capitalize on it. You can use it to your advantage. It's yours. Do whatever you want with it. And they also taught me that sex and sexuality and being sexy is fun. Like, have fun with it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a creative expression.
It's fun for their client, you know, for the blokes who you know, go in there, and the customers. But one imagines that it's not necessarily fun for them. I mean, it's work at the end, and it's cool. I mean, the book's called Money Game, and that's the whole point, right?
Yeah. Well, there are definitely clubs that have a more serious tone, but there are clubs that are a party.
Yeah.
And everyone's having fun, and I think a lot of the girls that are in the business are enjoying it. And they like nightlife, they like entertainment, they like talking to people, they like being out, they like drinking, they're good at conversation, you know, and they are enjoying themselves. And it's like any job, it has its like moments that are difficult or trying, but there's a lot of times that are enjoyable for them, and that's why they stick with it.
Yeah. So it's kind of a misconception to imagine that they're victims, or that they're not, you know, they're there because they've somehow been kind of, I don't know, that their choices are limited or something like that.
I mean, I didn't encounter that, really. I mean, I think like any profession, there's probably people in it that aren't quite suited for it, but I found, well, the majority of women I encountered were there with purpose and with dignity, and they were there because they wanted to be there. Mm-mm. I mean, I was looking at, you know, clubs in the United States in urban areas, in the big cities, and, you know, in one kind of section of the world. So I was looking where I was looking. But yeah, I mean, what I saw was empowered women.
Mm-mm-mm. In terms of the pictures, though, like, I guess the challenge in a way is to try and get something that isn't just the same stuff over and over again, right? Because you want to try and give a... How did you approach that, and what did you do about sort of tackling that problem of avoiding the kind of repetition of the, you know, stuff of them actually?
I think I probably just kept going to different cities and different clubs and different girls, and then after about 4 years, I felt like I had shot everything I could shoot. Mm-hmm. And, oh, and then I, you know, I photographed them in their lives. I went into their homes. I went into their businesses. I went into their events and got additional content that way, and and then after 4 years I had nothing more to shoot, so I stopped.
You got a little bit of the context, and it wasn't just the actual kind of stripping that
I stepped into their world, at different parts of their world.
Alright, well, thank you for telling me about it. And it's XYZ Books,
XYZ Books out of Lisbon. And the book is Money Game. I'm Elizabeth Waterman, and if you go to, you know, elizabethwaterman.com, you'll find links to the book and, you know, if you want to buy it in Europe, you go through XYZ, and if you want to buy it in America, you can contact, you know, the, I have a website set up for that, so, but yeah, terrific.
They'll find it.
All right, cool.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Yeah,
nice
thank
to chat
so
with you.
Yeah. Great question.
So I'm here with Michael Greco. Michael's got a show in the main event, which is called The Days of Punk. Is that right?
That's right.
Thank God I got it right. And it's a fascinating show. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about it, Michael. Well, how did it come about showing it here at Photo London, first of all?
Well, I knew the folks at Photo London, and Michael Benson, who runs the show, liked the work. I'd shown him the work, and the timing worked out that the book came out this past October, and, you know, you have to realize with COVID, we've been talking about doing something with the addition of Photo London in May of 2020. So it's been, you know, what is it, over 500 days since we couldn't do, that the show happened and it's been postponed. So it's one of the three public exhibitions here, so I'm really proud of that. Mm-hmm. And we've just gotten a great reception. It's been nice.
So tell us about it. Now, you don't quite look old enough to have photographed that era. You're probably probably about the same age as me, I would guess. Well, I was a mere kid, actually, for the Brit kind of punk scene, but this is the American punk scene, really, that you were there to photograph. What sort of bands did you document?
Well, so the Days of Punk project, and the book is called Punk, Post-Punk, New Wave, Backstage, On Stage, In Your Face, 1978 to 1991. So we had to come up with a title for the project that was a little shorter than the book title. Yeah. The book's with Abrams. I'm older than I look, which is I like the fact that you don't think of, but I'm 63, and so I started shooting in 78. I didn't see the Pistols. They never came to Boston. But, you know, I've shot Devo and The Clash and Pill and New Order and the Buzzcocks in 1980 and Susie in 1980 and 81. I've covered the gamut. There's 163 pictures in the book. There's 25 images in the Photo London public exhibition.
What kind of response do you get from the kind of younger generation who were not around for that particular era? Do you find that, you must get some quite interesting kind of feedback from that generation?
I don't think they realize that this was a time of rebellion, and I don't think they understand what it meant. I mean, people respond viscerally to the energy and the impact of the images, but I don't think they all get the greater picture of, it was a political rebellion here in the UK, and it was a musical social rebellion in the States. You couldn't get, unless you were a commercially produced mediocre rock band, you couldn't get played in the US because, the record companies were paying the DJs payola and cocaine. Mm-hmm. So, it was a musical rebellion. It cracked the system. It broke the system. It changed the record industry, it changed the radio industry, it changed the way we at the time listened to music. And that, I don't think people get that, and they're not just pictures of musicians and live concert pictures, it's a document of a time of wildness and rebellion and do as they would say, fuck all, whatever you want. Like, it was that's what it was really about.
Yeah. Well, and like you say, those, and also those bands laid the foundation for like everything that really came afterwards musically, because it had got to a point at that time when music had become maybe a little bit kind of convoluted and elitist in a way, really, I suppose.
Well, I think, I was one of the executive producers on the documentary Punk, which came out in the United States. And, in doing my research, the record companies realized there was so much money in selling records that they hedged their bets. They produced the bands. They found someone who was decent and they thought would be commercially acceptable. And they would then put them in the studio and develop their look and they produced music, and it wasn't authentic. And you got bands like Styx and Journey and Kansas and Boston, and to me, that was not music. Like, that was a record company concoction, right? So these bands thought, all right, we don't have to be the best musicians in the world, and we don't have to have the best studio. We know three chords, but we're going to put our everything behind it, our authenticity, our anger, our angst, our love, our, you know, we're going to put our passion behind it. And that's what comes out, you know, that's what those days were about.
Yeah,
and and it broke the music mold.
What drew you to it as a subject then at the time when you were, you know, younger and, you know, was it your sort of, as a photographer you were drawn to it, or was it as a lover of music, or was it a little bit of both kind of thing?
Oh, it was totally both. I mean, I was studying during the day but I was interning at the Associated Press. So I was a stringer for the Associated Press. I started in January of 78. My internship started then. And then a little bit afterwards, I wandered into the Ratskeller. And I was a jazz aficionado, loved jazz in New York, and I found jazz interesting. But I was still into the Velvets, the Velvet Underground, and Lou Reed, and Bowie. And I was exposed in high school to the Ramones and the Beat on the Brat and Blitzkrieg Bop record. But it wasn't until I went and saw the Boston Battle of the Bands at the Ratskeller, which is the night I went downstairs and saw this music live, and it was authentic again. You know, you have a band, La Peste, singing the song "You're Better Off Dead." It was like, it was wild, it was unusual, it was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it was both. It was I had the camera because I was a photographer, and it gave me a reason for being there. At the same time, I was interested in the music, so it fed off each other. It gave me access, but I was also accepted in that world because I was a club kid. I was a punker.
Yeah. So, yeah, how did you go in terms of, you know, your access to the bands? Were they in any way sort of suspicious of your motives, or, like you say, were they quite accepting from the start?
You know, it was a days of total access.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it wasn't so much of a thing that, then, really.
It was a days of total access, and I was shooting for Boston Rock Magazine, or WBCN was paying me, and they knew that, and it was part of their publicity, but I looked the part, I was the part, I knew the music, I knew their music, I was part of the scene. Mm-hmm. And if there were other people backstage from Boston, Oedipus, my buddy who was a DJ, they all knew me, and, you know, so they knew I was okay.
Then
we hung out. We were, you know, I'd party all night. I was friends with Billy Idol. I had the drummers for Adamant. Adamant made me hook him up with a date, someone he had a thing for. And I'd hang out with the drummers and, you know, hang out with the Clash backstage. Mm-hmm. And you were just accepted.
Yeah.
You know, you were part of the scene. And, you know, it's not like today, if you shoot a show today, if the photographers get to shoot three songs and then they're kicked out. Mm-hmm. It's like, We were backstage. We, like the book says, on stage, backstage, and in your face. Mm-hmm. We were a part of it. I mean, the thing is, just most of the time when we were in intimate settings and house parties and stuff like that, I didn't shoot. Like, I didn't cross that boundary of friendship.
Right.
But I had already spent the day with them and shot them live, but I usually didn't push that boundary of, you know, being backstage with Topper and doing lines of blow with him, photographing that.
Yeah, it's just kind of common sense, really, you know, to sort of, give people the impression or to let people know that, you know, you've got some judgment about those things, when to shoot and when not to shoot.
Exactly. In retrospect, I wish I'd pushed those boundaries a little bit more, because I looked at it, it was my archivist that said I had to do something with these images. And in retrospect, I realized I recorded history, and it was a cultural movement.
Mm. Yeah. So. Well, that's brilliant. I'm thank you so much for talking to me a little bit about it. And although people will not be able to see the show once Photo London is finished, there is the book. So that's the brilliant thing about it. It's like, you know, the listeners can go and check out the book and get the book if they're interested in the pictures. And it doesn't matter that the show's going to come and go. So, yeah, remind me again the full title of the book, because it's quite a...
The title of the book is Punk, Post-Punk, New Wave, On Stage, Backstage, In Your Face, 1978 to 1991, but everything's on the daysofpunk.com website.
Okay, brilliant. So they can find it there. Thank you, Michael.
Cheers.
Well, that's it. That's your lot, folks. Thank you very much for listening. That was Photo London 2021. Another occasion on which, despite myself, I managed to come here 3 days in a row, but only recorded today, Friday. So nice to catch up with people. This is, you know, really the first time anyone's kind of been out and about in a big group event and bumped into old friends. So inevitably, there are a lot of friends of the podcast featured. I hope that's all right with you lot. Didn't speak to any gallerists because, frankly, you know, they're here to do business and they're not going to say anything particularly interesting or honest, frankly, I don't think. They are going to sort of put out the party line, and what really am I going to ask them about? So I hope you weren't hoping to hear from gallerists. It was just nice to catch up with people whose names and voices you may well be familiar with, and hopefully a couple of extras on top. But that's it from me. I managed to have a couple of cocktails at least, so you know, that was in a way my end of Photo London celebration. And thanks for listening.